quarantine, we weren't successful. I was at a dinner the other night, and this guy came up to us and he started talking to us about going hunting. He hired an outfitter to take him, and we asked him where he's going. No idea where he's going. Who he's going with? No idea who he's going with. What he's hunting? No idea what he's hunting. I just remember being so frustrated sitting there. And my family, we struggled to be able to go out on the land to hunt. We're not going out there for a trophy hunt. We're going out there to feed our families. We haven't gotten a moose in a long time. Yeah, very frustrating to hear. And then he started talking about salmon, because me and my friends, they work in salmon conservation. And yeah, this guy was like, well, why are you working in salmon conservation? What's going on? We're like, well, the salmon are basically extinct here. There's almost no salmon. And he's like, what? Like, what are you talking about? And then he pulls out his phone and he's got 6 salmon on his boat with his son that he was so happy to show us. Like, stuff like that is so frustrating. People come up here and they think that they can hunt, take our traditional meats and traditions, and there's no remorse to it. Anyways, that was my rant.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it's important to hear, like, people say, sort of express emotions like that, because I think that one thing that people who are concerned about climate and who engage in, say, climate activism or environmental activism but aren't directly personally implicated by it yet, like, it's not yet affecting their livelihood, their ability to feed their family, their ability to practice their culture, it's not, like, as existential, right? And so this is where I think sometimes the sort of, like, climate anxiety, like, people who just think too much about things kind of starts to creep in. And I think when I heard you kind of talking, just describing how frustrating it is, it also really, like, gets across, though, a sense of urgency of just how important this is and why, like, I think you and so many other people are involved in the projects that you're involved in and do the work that you do, because it's not just, like, an abstract policy issue. It's very tied to your family. So thank you so much for sharing that. One thing I want to touch on, and I think Michelle as well, when we were discussing housing, you did touch on this already, the overdose crisis, addiction issues in the territory. One stat that I was sort of surprised by was that the Yukon is actually, I think, at the top of just jurisdictions, provinces and territories in terms of per capita drug-related deaths, which is pretty jarring. So the territory, as well as some of the First Nations, have declared states of emergency. So what are the various levels of government here doing, and what are maybe some opportunities that they have to do better to address this?
This is something that really has deeply affected all of our communities and the territory as a whole. And so we did experience a devastating amount of loss and continue to. That was an appropriate response, was to declare a health emergency. And I think some good things have happened because of that declaration. And within the city, you know, we made sure all our staff were trained on naloxone. And there's a poster on the door, same as there is on the theater, actually, the Knock for Naloxone campaign. So people know they can come to City Hall if they're, or someone that they're with, or is experiencing an overdose, and that the staff there can help them, and that there's going to be supplies there that can help them. And, you know, it has entered a lot more of our conversations, but it's been 18 months since we declared the health emergency. And I personally don't really feel like that's the way that we're acting. I feel very frustrated by these things, because it's like, it's this loss that we're experiencing was not an opportunity for a photo op. And it wasn't an opportunity to throw yourselves, like, a nice ceremony and pat yourself on the back and get the news media and all the accolades. And if we are going to do those things, then we need to do the actions that come with them. On my level of trying to bring these action items into the work that we do is, well, whose jurisdiction is it? Or, like, whose responsibility is that? And I just think, you know, we all acknowledge that we all have a role to play. And so, like, let's just figure it out, because people are dying and it's disproportionately affecting our Indigenous women. And, you know, we're also a signatory to the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Strategy. And so we committed to protecting Indigenous women. And here's a way that we can do that.
I call it something different. I call it a toxic drug supply. You know, it's across the territory, across the country, across North America, we're dealing with toxic drugs. And I totally agree with Michelle. We've called it an emergency, but we also called it an emergency when the Southern Lakes were flooding. The freaking army showed up. I haven't seen an army for the people that are dying. from the toxic drug supply. I've seen a government, all levels of government, municipal, First Nation, territorial, federal, struggle with how to approach this. Governments, by their nature, are risk adverse. They're not centers of innovation, right? Like, they're governments. They run off of electoral cycles. So in my mind, across the board, they need to be giving funding to the innovators, the ones who can come up and think outside of the box and try new things. Are you ever going to see a premier step up and say, you know what, let's try microdosing with mushrooms? No, right? It's not going to happen. But there's some really strong research that says actually that has a shot at it, right? And so, okay, premiers, you don't want to, you know, bring out shrooms, and fine, I get that. Give some money to an organization who can try that. Let's get out of this, you know, the government's not going to be the answer for this issue. No level of government's going to be the answer for this issue. And then I don't think we can talk about the toxic drug supply in the Yukon without talking about the history of colonization. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, you know what, I think I want to be a crackhead. It doesn't happen, right? It's because of the traumas. It's because of the history of colonization that we're dealing with. And until we talk about those root causes in the communities, we're not going to address this long term. And I think of my own community, Burwash Landing, no RCMP. I've personally called the RCMP to say a family member has been beaten up badly. And they've told me we'll be there in probably 4 to 6 days. And you're talking about drug dealers that are coming and squatting in houses. Like, there is just no way to tackle that type of history on your own. Even as a self-governing First Nation, we need resources, we need help, we need commitments, and we definitely need to be thinking outside the box.
Again, it's like, I don't know, disheartening to hear that the challenges are so similar, again, in such different places. But yeah, I think innovative policy solutions really are what's needed. And I don't know, in Oregon, they decriminalized mushrooms. So like, it's possible. Go Oregon. One thing I wanted to talk about was sort of what you all see as sources of growth and potential for the city of Whitehorse and also for the territory as a whole. I know that there's a lot of entrepreneurship in the city, that the Yukon has one of the highest populations of artists per capita as well among any province or territory in Canada. So what are the parts of the city, the economy, the territory that you all are excited to see sort of grow and evolve?
I know you mentioned the art scene, but I want to like emphasize that. And I'd love to see more Indigenous-owned businesses. You know, I know of a few youth who have like big dreams, big visions for businesses, and we need to find a way to nurture that and help our youth.
I hate being bored, so I'm always like, what's coming new? Language revitalization. I am so freaking excited about the number of young First Nation people that are learning their language, about the First Nations who've taken serious steps forward to acknowledge the importance of that work. And so we have a number of First Nations who are paying their students to learn their language. We have new programs that we've never seen before. So that piece, I think, is super exciting. Really excited about the future of telecoms in the north. We have a First Nation who is looking at creating their own First Nation internet service provider for the first time in the north. We've dealt with a monopoly here. Yukoners will know who I'm talking about. That company that shall not be named. The rest of Canada, they're a subsidiary Bell. And so I personally really tie Indigenous self-determination to the ability to have fast, reliable internet. You know, that's going to be a game changer. And so the telecoms future is changing of the territory. We're having conversations in the territory about First Nation ownership of energy. And that's pretty freaking cool. So I'm excited to see where that one goes. And then lastly, I just think the first time, at least in my career, I'm starting to see systems change. We're really good at programs and initiatives in the north. Ottawa's great at programs and initiatives. But we don't do a great job of shifting entire systems. And I see a whole bunch of systems that are right on the brink of big changes, including healthcare, child welfare, education. And I think that's not only good for Yukon First Nations, but we talked about the First Nations School Board. That's for all Yukon students. And all of our kids do better when they learn on the land. All of our citizens in the Yukon will do better if we have better healthcare. So these systems changes are pretty exciting in my view.
So I have a couple of sort of wrap-up questions, maybe quick hits that I can get just thoughts from all three of you on each of these questions. So my first question, I guess keeping in mind that the audio recording in theory of this is going to be disseminated to our listeners, many of whom probably have beliefs that are incorrect about the territories. Like being from just a smaller province, I notice all the time people think wrong things about Nova Scotia, like constantly. And so I imagine that especially those of you that do work in the South, you've probably had instances where people have just said stuff and you're like, who even told you that? Like, that's so not correct. Maybe if each of you have a common misconception of either just about the Yukon or what happens in the Yukon politically that you want to debunk for our listeners.
We don't live in igloos. I've been asked that plenty of times. Seriously. We also have a McDonald's here. I've also been asked that a few times.
The biggest one I want to debunk is that we don't have northern solutions to northern problems. We do not need it. We don't need Southerners to come up and fix us. We're not broken. What we need is for them to enable our solutions. And so I really, you know, every time I get a chance, I'm like, Ottawa, stop sending people up here. We can do it on our own.
Send money.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, a common misconception is that because we're smaller here, that we are somehow less effective, like politically or as governments. And so I think, actually, I was thinking back to when I ran territorially and there was this meme running around of like that big barge that got stuck. And then there was this little like tractor trying to dig it out. And so basically like the barge they put as like, this is the NDP's platform. And then the little tractor was like the budget. And like, they were just trying to say like that these ideas that we had that we were running on were like impossible.
So what do you all see as the most significant challenges and opportunities in this process of reconciliation in the territory?
I think the top three biggest challenges for reconciliation, my first one is we don't do a great job of creating safe spaces for people to have tough conversations. And I think in the Yukon, we've done about as much as we can on the low-hanging fruit of reconciliation. And now we're getting to the tough stuff, hunting rights, fishing rights, land, housing. And we're not going to be able to do that in a good way and make progress unless we make space for difficult conversations and have enough empathy for each other. And I use empathy because I think it's the skill set that we need for every major conversation in this global society of ours. It doesn't mean that I agree with you, but it means I can understand where you're coming from. And when you're talking about different worldviews at play, empathy is key. So that's my second biggest challenge is we need to be practicing and learning empathy more. That's going to be the answer to climate change. It's going to be the answer to the issues that we see with the divisions politically in the country, all of those pieces. And I don't think we talk about empathy enough, and I don't think we practice that skill enough. And then my last biggest challenge, I think, is these new narratives that are popping up. And here's the time for my rant. Man, I am so freaking pissed off about this narrative about why haven't you dug up any bodies at residential school? To the point where I'm spending, you know, I was recently sick, so I had a lot of bedtime, man. And I'm like right into the the comments on different things. And I think what I've come to the conclusion on, and one of the challenges to reconciliation is people aren't doing their own legwork. Like the TRC produced a huge document with a bunch of calls to action, and the vast majority of Canadians aren't talking about it. The vast majority of Canadians have never read the Indian Act. That's okay. It's really boring. I get it. But if you're going to have an opinion on something, then you got to do the legwork and at least understand that. And so, I had this conversation with several gentlemen yesterday who are really, they're like, okay, well, just show us proof that there's bodies there, that the church and the government did that. And so I do what I do, and I bring them. To me, what I would say is evidence, right? Here's some survivor stories. Here is work of archaeologists and ground surveys who have said these are disruptions. And here's the reports from the church on the children that died. And here's the reports from the TRC of the children didn't. Well, that's not actual proof. Right? Okay, well, then tell me what is your proof, right? And so then we get down to the nitty-gritty, which is why can't you just dig them up? And so my response back is, okay, do you have any idea how complex that is? And they hadn't thought about it, right? They're just like, well, go call the RCMP. Just go call the RCMP. They'll do your research, and then they'll dig it up. I'm like, you need anthropologists. You have to figure out DNA samples. You have to get consensus from the community, which we don't have right now in many of our Indigenous communities on how to handle that. Money? There's no unlimited source of funding to hire all these people to dig all of these pieces up. And I could see their eyes sort of switch, and they're like, oh yeah, we hadn't really thought about those pieces because it was easier for them to jump on, no, this didn't actually happen, there's no proof, all the politicians are lying, then to actually sit back and consider that all the evidence that's been in front of them for the last 20 years already says this has happened, right? And so that I think that's my third one for the challenge to reconciliation is these tough narratives that are coming out because people are not actually doing the hard work of learning.
And on that note, I'm going to call it. Thank you again so much. It has been a real treat to visit Whitehorse. Yeah, we've had a fantastic time. Thank you all. Yeah.
All right, let's adjourn. That's been The Backbench. We'll talk again in 2 weeks when I will be getting ready to bump Peace on Earth / Little Drummer Boy by Bing Crosby and David Bowie. I don't know where the year has gone, but that's where we're going. If you've been following along with what happens in Ottawa, let us know what you've been watching closely, what you'd like to hear us discuss, and what esoteric Canadian politics content you want us to break down. Send us your questions, your concerns, and your rants. You can email us at backbench@candleland.com, and we're also on Twitter at backbenchcast. I'm Matea Roach, and you can find me on Twitter at Matea Roach. The Carcross Desert is a series of sand dunes located in the southern part of the Yukon. The desert was formed during the last glacial period, which is what we know as the last ice age, when large glacial lakes formed and deposited silt. This episode was produced by Aviva Lassard and Noor Azria, with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofo. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Theme music is by Nathan Burley. A huge shout-out to the Yukon Theatre for hosting us and for making sure all of our listeners could hear the important conversation we had. Thank you so much specifically to Evan from the Yukon Film Society. We couldn't have done this without you. Thank you again to our panelists, Carissa Waugh, Michelle Friesen, and Tosh Southwick. Thank you for listening.
Sur mes selles, on m'a dit. space music any fun? I wonder, is the space music any fun?
Democracy Now!, hosted by award-winning independent journalist Amy Goodman. Tune in to your daily progressive news, aired Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. on CJSF.